Support for WFIU News comes from
Bunger & Robertson Attorneys at Law, utilizing 75 years of experience, knowledge, and resources to help individuals and families recover in personal injury matters. Information at lawbr.com.
Production support for Noon Edition comes from Smithville, fiber internet, security solutions, and voice in southern Indiana. More information at smithville.com. And from Bloomington Health Foundation, empowering a community and government partners by bringing together nonprofits, businesses, and philanthropists on initiatives to gain access to healthcare resources. Learn more at bloomhf.org. And from Estate and Downsizing Specialists, LLC, offering complete turnkey service for estate and downsizing clients, from initial consultation through home cleanout to final real estate and personal property sales. More at edsindiana.com.
Welcome to Noon Edition on WFIU. I'm your host, Bob Salzberg, along with co-host Lori McRobbie. Today we're talking with experts about how fewer Hoosiers are choosing to attend college after the first year after they graduate from high school. We have two guests with us today. In the studio with us is Sarah Ray, Associate Director of Financial Wellness and Education at Indiana University. And joining us over Zoom is Jillian Kinsey, Associate Director, the Center for Postsecondary Research and National Survey of Student Engagement Institute for Indiana University School of Education. If you have questions or comments, you can phone us at 812-855-0811 or toll free at 877-285-9348. You can also send your questions to news@indianapublicmedia.org. And you can follow us on X, formerly Twitter, at Noon Edition. So, Jillian and Sarah, it's great to have you both here today. Lori and I were talking before the program. We think, you know, just setting it up and, you know, what's changed, what's new. The catalyst for our show is, you know, recent surveys that talk about how Indiana statewide Indiana high school graduates aren't going immediately to college. The decline has been it was 66% in 2008, and now it's about 53%. It was still 65% in 2015, though. So the decline's been pretty steep. So, Sarah, let's start with you. I mean, give us sort of an overview of that decline, and what's it mean for your work?
Yeah, absolutely. So we've seen so many different social forces happening in the past few years, from the pandemic to a lot of discussion around financial aid and student loans. And just overall now this year, changes with the FAFSA. So I think overall, when we talk to young people and their families and their loved ones, there's some uncertainty around what is the payoff to going to college, right? Like, am I going to go spend a ton of money, go into a ton of debt, and then I might not be able to get a great job afterwards? So overall, for us in financial wellness and education, we really want to help students and their loved ones understand how they can afford that degree and why there is a good payoff to going to college.
Jillian, same question to you, yeah.
I'd love to add to what Sarah just said. And my perspective, I completely agree with everything she identified as vital to this conversation. But the other thing that I think is weighing on this that is a phenomenon across the country is just the lower numbers of college graduate or high school graduates, period. We have a demographic shift going on in higher education that affects higher education. So the lower birth rates, the fewer students graduating high school is another dimension of this challenge that we're seeing. And that's affecting the entire U.S., you know, differences by state to state and different population growth areas. But that's a reality. And the other one that Sarah mentioned is the perceptions about college value, I think, are again turned more to skepticism about the value. And that's a narrative that I think can change with some information and evidence. So I'd like to pursue that one as something that I think is important to address in the college going discussion is what is the perceived value of a college education. And I don't like to just equate it with earnings post-graduation or whether a student gets a job. I mean, those are important outcomes, but they're not the only ones that a college education affords. So I hope we can focus on that as part of this discussion as well.
You know, Jillian, you just said something really important to me, and this is one of those places where I'm just going to go off script a little bit and say, when I go to IU athletic events, I see ads on scoreboards about how go to this program at IU because graduates are getting out of school and they're making $75,000 a year or whatever it is. And that emphasis on how much money you make if you get out of a particular program always turns me off. So I think that's sort of in line with what you're saying. So talk about the values, in addition to just the salary you're going to make.
Yeah, well, as someone who is a lifelong learner and loves everything about what a college environment affords students in terms of their own personal and social and emotional growth, that can't be discounted. It shouldn't be discounted or devalued by elevating somehow it's all about what students earn when they leave the institution. I think it's hard to measure those kind of more ephemeral qualities of how much a student has grown or matured or taken on new leadership capacity because they were involved in a student club or are a student athlete. So I think there are all sorts of opportunities that college affords. It's such a rare environment for getting exposed to to arts and culture and all sorts of things that are important, and to take leadership with organizations where there's a supportive environment for learning and processing that, and for experiential learning like internships. So I think there's so much more, but of course, even in the amount of time that I've just described it, it's hard to describe it in a way that's concise and fits on a scoreboard promotion as you're encountering it. So I do think that there's a lot more to think about and value about a college education. And the other thing I'll just mention is, while I know our conversation and a lot of our tracking is about high school seniors enrolling in college, the other way to expand this conversation is think about adults earning post-secondary credentials. So these could be people who started a degree 10 years ago and didn't finish, or those who never attended and are in their 30s and 40s who are seeking a different opportunity in life. And I think going to college, it's never too late to earn a credential. And I know that's been an emphasis in Indiana overall, is to increase adults returning to college, people with some college and no degree, or those who never attended right after high school. So I'd like to expand our conversation to that as well.
Yeah, and just to add on to what Jillian said, absolutely. College provides so many opportunities. One of my favorite things to do in working with students is, even those that start college thinking about, you know, I'm going and I'm going to earn a particular degree to get a high salary, the ones that explore all their opportunities, including working in social services and public service, it's an amazing opportunity to have those conversations. And also explore things like public service student loan forgiveness for some of those students, and if things like that are options for them to go work in education in the community, not just in finance or particular industries that are perceived as high paying. So college gives students so many opportunities to just open up and expand their worlds, meet people who are from very diverse backgrounds that they might not meet otherwise. So, yeah, I really, really encourage high school students. But as Jillian said, really thinking about people who maybe started college and didn't complete or never went to college, especially those that started college, didn't complete, we really want to see if we can get them earning those degrees. If they have student loan debt, those are often the individuals that have the hardest time paying back that debt. Because they didn't get to engage in jobs that are higher earning that required that degree. So we do really want to see how can we get those students back enrolled in college and completed.
Yeah. Yeah. This is just such a such an important and timely topic. And I think a lot of things we can explore. But before we completely leave the kind of causal factors piece of this, I'm wondering if, I mean, obviously the pandemic had a huge effect on students in K through 12 environment, so ergo in high school students, even middle school students who experience learning loss or disruptions in their schooling. And that possibly is also leading to, I would imagine, in fact, I've seen articles that have talked about this, this lack of engagement in education, period. And then we have a strong economy at the moment, despite inflation. And so jobs are available. So I think, as Sarah, you said in the beginning, there's lots of factors that are affecting this. And the demographic piece, I think, is to some extent predictable, right? So those are, in theory, things that people could plan for, but not, you don't plan for a pandemic. I just wonder if how much you're seeing, if we even go back it kind of in the other direction away from the adult side into the K through 12 environment, even now, if some of the attitudes towards getting a degree are really coming out of the what happened to students during the pandemic.
Yeah, I would say that's very possible. And part of my graduate background is in developmental science. And so we know from various studies, some of them, for example, during the Great Depression, there's something called cohort effects. And that usually impacts children when they're very young. And so if some big event happened, like the pandemic, you start to see these trends that kind of impacted the whole cohort. And some of it is, you know, just the social conversation that's happening around them tends to impact them for a really long time and change attitudes and perceptions for years to come. So we definitely could be seeing that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Our research with the National Survey of Student Engagement, NESE, and all of the surveys that we do of entering students indicates that there is absolutely a lingering effect that has depressed some aspects of engagement, both in high school and in college. And we're going to see that linger for some time. And I think it makes it incumbent on educators at both the K-12 level and in colleges and universities to try and pick up and help students kind of re-socialize to connections and working with people face to face and being with people in organizations and leading clubs. So we do have a little makeup work to do around this that saw a real depression as a result of the disruption in learning through the pandemic. And I think, you know, as Sarah's just really identifying it, it has the potential to really be a cohort effect. And, you know, I think that is a concern as we move forward with this idea that it could also effectively depress even people's thinking about going into college as just something that they're not sure is going to offer them something more or vibrant or positive as part of their development.
How do you combat that? Sarah?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think it goes back to something that you said. It has to go beyond just talking about the money. It has to go beyond saying it's going to pay off in salary and wages. I think for a lot of young people, we need to emphasize the social experience. As Jillian identified, we have so many young people who are, you know, cut off from different social environments. The pandemic we've seen an uprise in loneliness, in just young people struggling with knowing how to even talk to friends. And so I think it's really important to say college is an opportunity to get out and build a social network, to make friends, and get to really develop your identity along with other people that are developing their identities. And I think that would be really appealing potentially to young people is it's an experience no matter what type of college or university you're going to.
Yeah. I mean, this obviously gets into the money question, the salary question, but I know I've heard from employers, too, that again, very anecdotal, but that employers value students who come in with a broader perspective on the world. They're able to think critically. They're able to write well and communicate well. And that for a lot of them, the technical skills that are needed for the job they've been hired for, they can train the new employees to do those things. To what extent, so again, thinking of, you know, how do you combat this this problem. Is there a path to talking with, you know, some of the big employers in the state of Indiana to be more vocal about the value of a recent college grad that comes out with this more holistic perspective on the world and their place in it, and able to work in a team? That's another big one, as a way to strengthen the argument. And
absolutely.
I don't know if you're seeing that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Lori, there's I just came upon the Association for American Colleges and Universities produced a report on career ready graduates, and it's all from the employer's perspective. And that resource really identified exactly what you're mentioning here, is that employers place a high value on these what are considered essential skills. Some might call them soft skills. I'm not a big fan of that. It makes it kind of devalues them, but it's the working with diverse others, understanding how to work in a team, appreciating the perspective taking, all these things that are not about content per se, but more about your orientation to learning and working with others and valuing different perspectives that a college and university education engenders and supports in students. And those, that kind of information, I think, could be really helpful to get out among the college-going population and with families and students to emphasize that these things are developed in colleges and universities, these essential skills, and that employers value them greatly. Employers are saying it. They value
right.
it.
Right.
And I think that's important. And I'll just add one other resource to something that Sarah mentioned about connections. There is this important dimension of connections and social relationships that needs to be slightly repaired, and students need some help. And there's a free resource that's available to college students, and it's called Connections Are Everything, A College Student's Guide to Relationship-Rich Education. And it's, I think, a wonderful guide for prospective students and families to be thinking about and reviewing as they consider what college really offers them and the opportunities that it affords. So it's called Connections Are Everything, and it's a free resource available to students.
Let me give our contact information if you want to join our conversation today about the decrease in high school students who have been going on in their first year after graduation to college. That's what we're talking about today on Noon Edition. If you want to join our conversation, if you have a question or a comment, 812-855-0811 is our local number. 877-285-9348 is our toll-free number. And you can also send questions to news@indianapublicmedia.org, or you can join us on X, formerly Twitter, at Noon Edition. It's kind of a sensitive area, I think, but I do want to ask. You know, we're talking about soft skills and, you know, talking about all the values that go beyond the financial end of it and making money. How much is our current sort of division, political division, is that having an impact on kids coming out of high school ready to just go on to university? Jillian, I want to start with you.
Yeah, I'm afraid to say I think it has an impact. And partly it's, you know, we've seen not only in Indiana, but of course, far worse intrusions from legislators into educational content and how it's provided and what is provided and who can provide it. And I think it's a real overstep in several state legislators, and I think we've seen some of that in Indiana recently with some efforts to try and reduce faculty's ability to deliver content and to know what's educationally important for students. Mm-hmm. You know, and to me, it's unfortunate that educators are not trusted in a way that allows them to decide what students need. And when we hear corroborating information from employers, so industry leaders in the state who say how important it is for students to learn essential skills like relating to people who are different than them, and that they get exposure to ideas that are different and that cause them to have to reconcile different points of view. We shouldn't suppress those kinds of conversations. They're an important part of being a person in the world today and in the state today. So I'd like to see a little bit less intrusion from the state legislator and more confidence and encouragement in students gaining those kinds of experiences in college.
Yeah, and then for me, just anecdotally, for students that I talk to from a multitude of backgrounds, they're seeing this type of legislation and saying, you know, am I going to really be welcome on this college campus, this university campus? And so I think we need to be really aware of the diversity of students that we serve too, and just what psychological impact this legislation is having on them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It is a particularly difficult time, and it's frustrating, I think, for all of us who have been in education for, you know, our whole lives in many of our cases, and it's just, you sort of run out of the right arguments to make about this, and you just obviously have to continue to send the message that people are welcome. But I wondered if this is also, I wanted to ask a question about just alternatives to college in general, and what kind of an effect, if you will, competition with traditional, let's just say, public or private university educations, how much that has increased, and again, perhaps has an effect on the degree to which students are picking traditional college experiences versus something else, which in the grand scheme of things is maybe still really good. They're going on to post-secondary training of some kind. But I wonder if both of you can speak to that issue of, you know, alternatives being developed now. And again, just given the coming out of the discussion about politics, obviously some of them are motivated by, if you will, having very specific kinds of educational experiences that align with people's particular values. But we've also seen a lot of other models out there, too. Can you both talk to those competition factors, if you will?
Yeah, I'll start. Sarah, I hope you can weigh in, too. The mm-hmm. the piece that is exciting for me is, I think, alternative credentials, short-term, stackable credentials that offer students a real expertise in a particular topic or subject or industry need. I think there's real value to that. I have some worry about a lot of for-profit industries or organizations getting involved in that, because it raises questions about what comes first, student learning and industry needs or profitability. So I do have some worry, and I would want a lot of oversight over some of those. But in general, I think alternative credentials are a way to help get students into post-secondary education if they are get the message that credentials should be stackable and lead to more credentials. So if a student can start by earning a credential in a particular industry-related skill, maybe they can go on and earn an associate's degree and then maybe a four-year degree or beyond, master's level education that's needed to advance in their career. So I think there's some value in that, and I don't necessarily see it as competition as long as it's not the end of the educational route. The other thing that I think is really useful is if we can partner with industry in the state to identify what the real needs are and where there is a yawning gap in employees. So if it's healthcare, industry production, and agriculture in Indiana, if those are the top areas that really need students with advanced degrees, let's start with some credential building and then work with the two.
Oh, oop. We seem to have lost Jillian. Go ahead.
Yeah, Sarah. I mean, I can take it away from here. So, yeah, as Jillian was talking about, I think that those types of, industry-specific programs, stackable programs, can be amazing opportunities for students from all different sorts of backgrounds to get engaged in post-secondary education, specifically students that are uncertain about the cost, or they're just not sure what they want to do yet. Those can be amazing credentials. My hope for those types of programs is that we're really emphasizing programs coming out of community college so that students are engaged in the higher education system, and that we are also, as part of those programs, still giving students opportunities to engage in understanding that lifelong learning is important, that there is an aspect of liberal education and civics education as part of those programs. Because, of course, we know that's an amazing part of being engaged in higher education, as we talked about earlier, it's not just the money, it's the being a lifelong learner and knowing how to be a good global citizen.
We have a phone call from Valerie. We want to take that phone call now. Valerie?
Yeah.
Hey, go ahead. Valerie, go ahead.
Okay. I have a comment, really. I've got a comment. This is mainly regarding all of the reasons that a college degree is valuable beyond how much money you're going to make. And I've got a bachelor's degree in biology and also a master of library and information science. And I just want to say that I went to school for a year and then dropped out and went back at an advanced age. I think I was in my 40s. And what you're exposed to on the college campus in terms of relationships and the kind of people you make and what you learn in terms of learning how to think, learning how to evaluate information, just widening your capacity for intelligent judgment, I don't think you can put a dollar value on that. I mean, that really made me the person that I am in terms of living in the world. And unfortunately, I know you say the economy is good, but I think when, you know, half the people who are renters can't afford to pay rent in this country, it may be good for some people. But I think that one of the big reasons that people don't want to go to college is it costs too much. Yeah. You know, it's going and buying a steak. It costs too much. You know, if the choice is to have a roof over your head or go to college, it's kind of a no-brainer. And unfortunately for me, partly due to my own lack of career motivation, but partly just the environment of living around Bloomington, having two college degrees hasn't paid off financially. And I would be, in this day and age, extremely hesitant to go into debt to go to college just because trying to survive. I mean, you don't hear about the people at the bottom. You know, you hear about the middle class. But there are so many millions of people in this country that are financially so desperate.
Yeah.
And as I said, if it's a question of buying food or going to college, it's a no-brainer. But the value of what you are exposed to on a college campus, you cannot put a dollar value on that. That is turns you into a thinking person. They teach you how to think, how to ask questions, and that's why it's so disturbing politically to see state legislatures, including our own, going after the whole concept of academic freedom and, you know, questioning tenure, because that's going to destroy a lot of what the real value is of going to college if they succeed in that. So that's my comment.
Thank you, Valerie. We're going to pursue some of your topics here. I think the cost issue is the first one. And Sarah, you would be a good one to address that.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think my big response to the cost issue is, you know, college is expensive, but we do know that by and large, people that earn college degrees make far more money over a lifetime than those that do not earn degrees. And that's across all majors, all different sectors of the economy. So there are some economic changes, but that still rings true that a college degree does provide higher lifetime earnings. And so to address the issue around student loan debt, right, like the media is talking a lot about student loan debt. We see the Biden administration addressing different issues. And student loan debt is a huge concern. It's a concern every single day in my work as I work with students and I manage staff who work with students. But there are some really good available options for financial aid and different forms of support. So always make sure that, you know, you're exploring your scholarship and grant opportunities. Student employment is another amazing opportunity to make college affordable. I'm a huge proponent of student employment. Our office at here at IU employs student workers. And to just go into something we talked about earlier, student employment is one of those ways that students can engage in building those high demand skills, as well as, you know, earning some money that can help them cover different college costs. But for students and families that are looking at still having a gap and perhaps needing to borrow to go to college, make sure that you are really fully exploring what is available as far as federal direct loans. Those are probably going to be your best bet as far as borrowing. I have seen students that I've worked with and their families go to private loans or Parent PLUS loans first, which are often very high cost, high interest rate types of loans that don't have a lot of the protections that federal direct loans have. So, you know, there's the whole issue of the FAFSA and the complications of the FAFSA. Right. You have to fill out the FAFSA to be eligible for federal help, including those federal direct loans. But those are often going to be the best option for borrowing if families are looking at borrowing.
So what are the issues with FAFSA at this point?
Yeah, at this point. Yeah. So in the last several years, Congress passed the FAFSA Simplification Act, which is, for all intents and purposes, actually a really good thing long term. The problem's been with the rollout, as we've seen with other, you know, pieces of legislation in the past couple of decades. Rollout often becomes the problem. So the Department of Education, as they were, you know, implementing the FAFSA Simplification Act, those deadlines kept getting pushed back. And so in a normal year, the FAFSA opens on October 1st. And we always encourage students and their different key partners in completing the FAFSA to get that completed as soon as possible after October 1st. Well, the Department of Education kept pushing that deadline back, and it didn't open until December 31st. And then there was a lot of issues with the FAFSA form. And then in addition to that, the Department of Education has made several different calculation errors in how the new FAFSA formulas work. And so it's causing some big problems around that information from the FAFSA getting to the financial aid departments at the different institutions where students are applying. And so then those financial aid departments can't get those, you know, the financial aid information out to students to know how much college is ultimately going to cost at those institutions. So it's just been a whole storm of problems with the rollout of the FAFSA Simplification Act.
See any light at the end of the tunnel?
Yeah.
So I would say, I mean, things are getting processed, getting resolved. I know across different institutions, financial aid departments are working as hard as they can for students. So that's always my light at the end of the tunnel, is my fellow colleagues here at IU, at other institutions where I've worked, they're working as hard as they can for students and their loved ones to get that information out to them. And so I would say for students and their loved ones that have applied to college, keep reaching out to financial aid and student financial services at the institutions where you're applying to get that information that you need.
We're talking with Sarah Ray, Associate Director of Financial Wellness and Education at IU, and Jillian Kinsey, Associate Director for the Center for Post-Secondary Research and the National Survey of Student Engagement Institute for IU. If you have questions or comments in our last 20 minutes on the show, 855-0811 or toll free at 877-285-9348. You can also send your questions to news@indianapublicmedia.org.
Just a question on the FAFSA. So as things stand today, families can fill it out and get information in. It's a question of what's happening on the back end and how that information is flowing out to the universities where
That's
they're
correct.
Not going to be able to get an answer back.
Yeah, That's correct. So there's institutions, and I'm not sure what the date right now is for IU, but there's institutions that are looking at they're not going to be able to get those financial aid letters out to families until very late in the spring, early summer. And that's really too late for all families to do really good planning.
Yeah. So students, go ahead, Julian.
One other dimension. Yeah, one other dimension on this I think is important is for students that might be trying to make a good choice between maybe two institutions in Indiana or more, that, you know, it's nice for them to have that information, but they shouldn't, I don't want students to give up at this point because they haven't heard or they don't have a finalized financial aid package yet due to some of these problems in FAFSA. So the most important thing I think for families is to, one, not give up on their first choice just because it hasn't been completed yet, and to communicate with their institutions that they really are interested in, to say, I just haven't heard, I need a little bit more time, we need to arrange this, and I hope that that affordance can be given by financial aid offices. But I think that's an important thing. Please don't give up, families.
Yeah.
I loved you, Sarah, talking about student employment, and that obviously comes in a variety of forms. I know I was a work-study student when I was in college, and it was not just a great way to help pay for college, which was a lot cheaper back then, but it was the experience that those work-study jobs themselves were as valuable to me as the courses that I was taking. And so that's obviously one model. But are there other models, such as students being able to get college credit for internships that they do? Is that a growing trend? Am I just noticing it?
No, I mean, I would say, credit for internships has been a thing for as long as I can remember. It certainly was a thing when I was in school back in the early 2010s. So that is definitely something to look at. I would say when a student is starting out as a freshman, some of the best ways to connect into that is seeking an on-campus employment opportunity, because those supervisors you work with on your on-campus job also often lead to the next job or internship.
Right.
Really talking to faculty and staff members. And then really using all the resources of your career services center.
Right.
So those are really good ways. I think the other thing to keep in mind for students, and this goes back all the way to students that are currently in high school, as well as students that are thinking about college or are currently in college, is there are opportunities to take credits at two-year institutions and transfer them in. So for students that are currently in high school, they can take college credits, sometimes at no cost or for very low cost, and take those so that they count for their high school courses as well as college credit, transfer them into an institution, and they might be at the point where they can graduate a semester to a year early if they take enough credits during high school. There's also opportunities to start at a two-year institution and get your associate's degree first. That's what I did when I was in school. And then in addition to that, going and maybe even looking at if you're at a four-year institution, you can still take those lower cost credits during a summer or like a winter semester and get cheaper credits that way. And then at various state institutions, like here at IU, we have banded tuition. So for students that are taking 12 to 18 credits, which is full time, all those credits are covered under one flat rate. So you can take 12 credits, 15 credits, or 18 credits, and you're paying one tuition price, which is amazing. And so for students that are able to handle the course load, mm-hmm. it might be worth taking 15 or 18 credits instead of the minimum 12 credits.
Yeah. So just to clarify, I meant in terms of internship credit and pay. Right. And income. And
right.
That's because.
So that's something that students will need to be careful of, mm-hmm. is there are potentially internships that you can do not for pay and just for credit. There's internships you just do for pay. There's internships you do for both. So really making sure that the student talks to their faculty, advisors, and the institution or company that they're doing the internship with to figure out what that looks like for them. There's also some degree programs that require internships.
Right.
So really, it's a matter of a lot of good planning, starting with an advisor and perhaps faculty in a company or institution you're looking at working with.
Yeah. Jillian,
one more plug for the work study that Lori mentioned too. You know, it's often declined on a student's financial aid package, partly because students, I don't think, understand it, or there's an unfortunate perception that somehow working while you're in college is a distraction. And I would argue the opposite. I think it actually, on-campus employment can actually help root and make a student feel even more a part of a campus and gain valued learning experiences at the same time. So a reasonable number of hours, like 10 or 12 hours a week, is perfectly appropriate and can be a way for a student to earn some funds while they're going to school through their financial aid work study package.
Yeah,
and just to add on to what Jillian said, there actually are a handful of studies that demonstrate that working between 12 and 20 hours per week on specifically an on-campus job actually helps students achieve higher GPAs potentially. So students that work 10 to 20 hours per week on average have higher GPAs than those who work fewer hours or don't work at all. And then we do see, again, that students build out amazing networks, build social skills. And so one of the biggest reasons I'm an advocate for student employment is because I was employed all the way through school. And the reason I work in my current field is because staff and faculty I worked with got me engaged in financial education.
Really,
it can be the making of a career.
Yeah. And a lot of work study positions, this is true for me too, line up with your major. Yeah. So that's why for me, my work study experience was like another class because I was applying a lot of the stuff I was learning in the classroom and it was all part of what I was trying to study. So it's not just that you're in the cafeteria schlepping trays, which has other benefits, of course, but so that's another piece of it as well.
Yeah. Jillian, I wanted to ask you about the most recent survey of student engagement. And what are some of the key takeaways that you have from that might help us, you know, understand what's happening with our, you know, the high school students who are opting to not go to school right away?
Yeah, well, I mentioned one already, that we're seeing some students who are leaving high school with very low expectations about what they're going to do in college and how they'll be engaged. And I think that's a real concern. And ways to elevate those expectations for the kind of engagements like being a leader in an organization and going to events and all of those important dimensions of a college education is one thing I would like to see heightened in high school K-12 education as a value of college. And the other thing I think we're noticing in our survey work is about the importance of students' identities and that they need to feel like they are seen and heard based on their identity. So having cultural organizations that represent who they are and finding a affinity group, whether that's a club or organization that's based on your racial ethnic identification or your religious beliefs or your whatever meaningful identity you hold, is critically important at this stage where people are seeking connections. So I think that's a really important survey finding, is just the importance of helping all students feel welcome and their ability to be successful in college.
I have a follow-up to that because we got a question from Wendy who sent her question in through one of our channels. The political divide has caused a lot of distrust in universities and professors. How can they reach those students and how can they ensure that those students don't feel isolated or not have their thoughts and opinions heard? Jillian?
Oh my gosh, I'm happy for the question, and I think it already suggests the answer, which is we need to do more to help students feel welcome in the college environment, and they need to hear, and students need to hear that from all the adults on campus, whether that's the person who works in the cafeteria or the person who is the groundskeeper or the advisor that they interact with or their faculty. They need to feel like there are folks there that are pulling for them and that are welcoming of their identities. So if, you know, whether a campus, you know, we think about it most visibly in physical disabilities. So students who are physically unable to climb steps or they need a wheelchair ramp, we think about those kind of accommodations, and those have become acceptable now in higher education. And we need to do more, of course, to make all students of all abilities feel welcome. But at the same time, we need to make sure that students who are GLBT and trans feel comfortable on a college campus. And that can be done by professors who signal that those students are accepted, that research, that readings are pertinent to their cultural and social identities. So it takes an institution effort to create a welcoming and hospitable environment for all students. And we need to do more of that, frankly.
Yeah, so. And to add on to that, so an organization called Trellis has done some amazing survey research over the past few years, and they just recently worked with IU to survey our students. And we are seeing so many students that have a lack of basic resources. So many students have very low food security or lack of transportation. We're seeing higher rates of homelessness among students. And there's a lot of shame and stigma when students experience those things. So I know when I have been an instructor of courses at various institutions, I make sure that there is always a place open for students to come talk to me during office hours or after class. And I really make sure that early in class, I talk about different issues that students might experience and just know that I'm a safe person to come talk to. And I know so many of our faculty and staff members do that. And then we're also quite open about our own identities. So I'm a person with a disability, and I speak very frankly to students about that so that they know you are not alone when you are facing all of these issues. For any student that is in college now or looking to go to college, know that so many of our faculty and staff members want to assist you in these issues.
Yeah. Quick follow-up from Wendy, and also I was going to ask this too. You know, our Indiana legislature would say that we're not kind enough or we're not hospitable enough to conservative students on campus. So Jillian, I wanted to give you an opportunity to address that too.
Oh boy, that's a doozy. I think we need to make sure that the environment is welcoming to all students. But I have to say that I would respectfully disagree with that perspective. Now, I don't think it's a problem. However, I do understand with students expressing feeling like they can't express themselves in a certain way. So I don't want to discount what students are saying, but I think making this a major problem is the thing I object to. I think there's plenty of space for perspectives on campus, and we need to cultivate all those perspectives. But I don't want that view that somehow the conservative perspective is being suppressed. That is not happening to a greater degree by any evidence that I have. What is being suppressed are views that are different, that are perhaps not from the majority population. I think those are the views that are being suppressed on a college campus.
Yeah, and I would say just being on a university campus, we want open discussion, and we really want people to be able to debate different viewpoints and different worldviews. And so as an instructor, and now as a staff member, I always ask students, just let's be kind in our discussion. Let's debate ideas, but not attack people. And so I think that is really the standard that we want to demonstrate in higher ed.
Yeah, I think it goes to a comment one of you made some time back about the importance of civic education, beyond the dubbed the soft skills and teamwork and collaboration and so forth. But it is the degree to which part of what makes a campus welcoming is the peer support that you get. So every student coming in, also, I the little that I've done with teaching and so forth and being around students, as well as to try to help students and support students in how they can be a source of support and outreach and openness to others, that part of that sense of belonging comes from the peer group, too. And that even goes for people who come from underrepresented populations.
Yeah.
And that's a hard point to make sometimes, but I think that's got to be in the mix as well.
Absolutely.
Well, and we should be fostering that kind of dialogue.
Yeah.
This is the protected and the environment for this to happen, when there's some guardrails, there's some guidance, there's some educators who kind of been around and know this territory. This is the place to have those kind of debates in a way that promotes dialogue.
We're almost out of time. We have about 2 minutes to go. So any last comments, Jillian first, and then Sarah can wrap it up. Anything you wanted to say today that you just haven't had the opportunity to say?
I'll just say that I want people to, families and students, to be encouraged about higher education and really see it as an investment in their future. It's, perceiving it as a something that causes debt is a perspective. I realize there is a reality, but if we could shift our point of view into one that thinks about it as an investment in the kinds of learning and experiences that we want people to have to be good citizens in our state and in our communities, that's what I want to think about it as.
Okay, Sarah?
Yeah, and I would definitely say, as Jillian said earlier, make sure that you are reaching out to the institutions you're exploring. I definitely have said that. But for any students and their loved ones who are potentially looking at one of our IU campuses as an option, make sure you're talking to my office, Financial Wellness and Education. You can look us up at moneysmarts.iu.edu. Student Central is an amazing resource here. And we are more than happy to talk to prospective students and their loved ones and just start exploring what options they have.
All right. Thank you, Sarah Ray, Associate Director of Financial Wellness and Education, and Jillian Kinsey. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Associate Director of Center for Postsecondary Research and the National Survey of Student Engagement Institute for Indiana University School of Education. For my co-host, Lori McRobbie, engineer Mike Pashkash, and producer Nathan Moore, I'm Bob Salzberg. Thanks for listening to Noon Edition.
Production support for Noon Edition comes from Smithville, fiber internet, security solutions, and voice in southern Indiana. More information at smithville.com. And from Bloomington Health Foundation, empowering a community and government partners by bringing together nonprofits, businesses, and philanthropists on initiatives to gain access to healthcare resources. Learn more at bloomhf.org. And from Estate and Downsizing Specialists, LLC, offering complete turnkey service for estate and downsizing clients, from initial consultation through home cleanout to final real estate and personal property sales. More at edsindiana.com.
Support for WFIU comes from our sustainers and from Simon & Schuster and Emily Bestler Books, proud publishers of Lost Man's Lane, a thriller set in Bloomington in 1999, written by Scott Carson, a pen name for Bloomington native Michael Carita.